Hi, I'm Nancy White. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank the committee for inviting me to speak tonight. Also, the previous speakers, Jan and Philip, I really enjoyed your talks. I love things that are spoken from the heart. Love that language of the heart. Also, thank you, Scott, for being the taper. I'm addicted to the CDs. I go and buy a bunch of them, which makes my husband crazy. My sobriety date is October 4th of 2000. I messed that up. I was speaking to a Rotary Club a little while ago about, you know, myself and our business, and I said that I was working, started this treatment center, and that my sobriety date was October 4th, 2020. And I was like, oh no, 2020 on the brain. It's been a wild year. A friend of mine had to pull on my sleeve and go, Nancy, 2000. Oh yeah. So I do everything in even numbers, apparently, in my life. I was born in 1960, got married in 1990, and graduated medical school that year too, and then got sober in 2000. And I was real excited about 2020, because I thought, ooh, what cool thing is gonna happen? You know, but I think there's a lot of things that happened in 2020 that were really cool in the recovery world. The Zoom meetings, I know people don't really like that. That's two-dimensional, not the three-dimensional, you know, where you can hug, can't hug the screen. But, you know, all the connections, being able to connect with people around the world in meetings that we just didn't do before, I think that's amazing, and what a small world it is. Especially when I came here and saw a lot of faces that I recognized. I was surprised. This is my first time at Monteagle. I was excited to come. I did come up here, I think, in the fall of this year. We got a little COVID crazy. We were tired of being in the house, and my husband Andrew wanted to bring me up here. He raved about this conference. And so we came up here and looked around Sewanee, and he showed me this building here, and it was just so neat. So I was really looking forward to being able to come up here. I have a sponsor whom I love dearly. She's pretty much been my sponsor since I got sober, which I think is sort of unusual. She's gone through three sponsors, I think, and it was so neat to watch that process, because she would let go of the sponsor for a very good reason. One, she wanted to grow, and she talked her, she would share that with me, the pain she was going through, because she loved her other sponsor, but, you know, this other person had something that she needed and wanted. And I was just in amazement, because I'd never do that, I wouldn't want to hurt somebody's feelings. But it was so neat to watch her grow and live this program, and that was really cool for me. I needed someone that lived this program to show me how. I needed God with skin on him, and she was that person. Although she told me, don't make me your God. I will disappoint you greatly. My job is to get you to God, and that's what those steps are about. I believe I was born with alcoholism. I didn't have my first drink until I was 17 years old. I was an army brat. There were five kids in my family. We were all stair steps. And my dad loved to travel. Anytime he got an opportunity to go overseas, he would take it. We moved around a lot. I never lived anywhere for more than a few years. And I say I was born with alcoholism because I loved that. I loved to be able to move, because I felt like I could reinvent myself. I never felt a part of the rest of the world. I was a weird kid. I lived in a fantasy world. I loved, especially as a young teen, I'd stay by myself in my room and listen to John Denver and, you know, my sisters, everybody thought I was weird. And I had some close friends, just a very few, because I didn't feel comfortable going out and meeting people. I felt like I was over here and everyone else was over here. And I wanted to be over there with the rest of you, but I just didn't fit in. And felt that way really until I came into these rooms. I was so glad to find my people. And I never would have thought alcoholics would be my people. Growing up, the thought of alcohol or drugs was just so foreign to me. Neither one of my parents drank. My dad would drink socially. He collected miniatures, but he would have those on rare occasions when he'd have his friends over. I really wasn't exposed to it. When we had an opportunity, this is crazy, but here I was I was about to start my senior year of high school. My dad had an opportunity to go to Iran. Tehran, Iran. I was in the last graduating class from Tehran, Iran American High School because that's when Khomeini took over and the Americans were kicked out. But I'd already come back to start school. While I was over there, right before I started classes, when you would go to Tehran, you stayed at the Avin Hotel. That's where everybody was until you got assigned an apartment or housing, which was out there with the rest of the folks. They found an apartment building for us, but before we could move in, I'd met a girl who was a year younger than me. And she was so sweet. I hung out with really nerdy, nice people, and she had this little high-pitched voice and dimples, and she was a year younger than me, cute as a button, little blonde. She asked me if I wanted to go down to the bar, which was in the Avin Hotel downstairs. I'm a good go-alonger, apparently. I said, yeah, sure. Now, I didn't know anything about drinking. I didn't know that she was a big partier. She grew up in the beaches of Florida and apparently partied a lot in high school. She didn't look the part, but anyway, I went down there with her I just wanted her approval. So I thought, okay, I'll order something. What do I know? The only drink I knew was a screwdriver. So I ordered one of those and told the bartender to make it a double, because that's what I'd heard in the movies or something. I had no idea what I was doing. And then, of course, I had no idea how to drink. I picked it up and I just chugged it. And I was all of maybe 108, 110 pounds then. So that hit me. And then we were walking out of the bar. I floated out of the bar. I floated up those steps. And I really liked the way I felt. It felt like this nice, wonderful cushion between me and the world. And it was the first time I felt comfortable. And I hung on to that feeling. While I was there, it's amazing I made it through high school, but I happened to do it. While I was there, this girl talked me into getting a job with her at Tehran American Hospital. They had these nurses' aide positions. She wanted to be a nurse. I wanted to be a doctor. Ever since I was a little kid, when I'd be at the playground, I always had Band-Aids in my pocket. I always wanted to put a Band-Aid on someone. please, somebody get hurt. And I don't know where that came from. We don't have anybody in the medical field in our family. I don't know where it came from, but I always wanted to do that. So when that opportunity became available where we could work on our weekends, took it and started hanging out with the medics. Well, the medics were notorious for drinking and drugging and everything. So with them, again, I'm a good go-alonger. I just wanted to fit in and started smoking outside issues over there and drinking with them, and we had a whole lot of fun. Like I said, I'm surprised I made it out of high school, but I did. I managed to graduate. But then I needed to come back to the States. My parents were supposed to be there for another year, and my dad told me, you will be going back to Huntsville, Alabama. You will be going to UAH. I thought I could pick any school I wanted to. I didn't know anything about money, but so that's where I went. And again, I just knew I wanted to be a doctor. I quit smoking the outside issues because I couldn't function in school and do that. And my desire to go to medical school was so strong. While I was in college, my husband was finishing up, well, he was about to be my boyfriend, went on a blind date with this guy named Andrew, and we were both completely stoned when we met, and then later that evening, drunk. That was it for us. You know, we were basically together. Brief stint of breaking up, but for the most part, we'd been together, and that was back in 1982. We ended up getting married in 1990 when I finished medical school. I didn't drink much in medical school. I was very focused on, I've got to study, I've got to be able to do this. And so I don't think I'd crossed that invisible line into alcoholism yet. There were several times I got drunk, and even blackout drunk once before I started medical school, but no, when I was there, I was totally focused. I got through that and through residency and decided I wanted to be a family practitioner because that was about the most holistic thing I could do, because everything I tried, I wanted to do it. Okay, I'm going to be a trauma surgeon. No, I'm going to be a psychiatrist. No, I'm going to be a neurologist. You know, I just wanted to do everything, pediatrician, whatever. And family practice was a thing that sort of fit for me. Came back to Huntsville in 90 when I graduated, married my husband, did my residency from 90 to 93, and then things got a little awkward for me because I was so used to having my life laid out for me by other people. That was sort of a security for me. You know, you're going to take this rotation, you're going to do this next. But you know, you graduate medical school and they go, see you later. Enjoy your life. I knew nothing about a practice. And it was Decatur General at the time had offered to set me up in practice. And I thought, well, okay, that's close to home, we'll do that. So I started in practice there, and I was so stressed out because, again, I knew nothing about business. You know, I knew how to, I could take care of you on a ventilator. If your heart stops, I can do stuff about that. But I knew nothing about basically the common cold. I was constantly, well, it was before we had computers, I was constantly running into my office to read up on stuff. I had a ton of books. It was like, excuse me, I'll be right back. Run in there and then come back and take care of my patients. And it was just a very stressful time for me. I loved it, but very stressful. And also I hated paperwork with a passion. Just hated it. And there was a lot of that. Early on, I remember one evening sitting there with my charts. The rest of the staff got to go home, and I'm feeling sorry for myself. And I don't know if I was sick at the time or just experimenting, but I remembered that the drug reps had dropped off samples of this cough syrup. If it helps, it had alcohol in it. But it also had this stuff called hydrocodone in it. And I took it down. I got my little measuring cup thing, measured out the dosage. Took it, sat down, I was doing my paperwork, and within just a few minutes, I was like, wow, paperwork is kind of fun now. You know, this isn't so bad at all. And then immediately in my mind, this is what I thought. You know, I don't really care for drinking that much, and a lot of people, when they finish work, will go home and have a drink. This is a lot like that. So I immediately rationalized and justified in my mind this was a thing that I could do. And I did that intermittently. I got pregnant. It was an immaculate conception shortly thereafter. And so I didn't do any of that. I did not drink. I didn't take any of that. I thought I had hepatitis because I was taking care of some patients with hepatitis, but because I was nauseated and tired. My husband talked me into doing a pregnancy test at my office, and I was in shock because I don't remember how could this happen. How I was a busy woman. I didn't have time for hanky-panky or anything, and he reminded me. He said, you know, remember that fight we had and we made up? Oh, I really didn't remember it, but I still think Alex is an immaculate conception. He's the new Christ child. Anyway, but we had two more after that. During that time, you know, after the pregnancy, I knew I could drink some again and I could do this other stuff. And the drug reps were calling me right and left. Hey, Dr. White, do you need more samples? Well, yes, I do. Thank you very much. You know, I didn't have to go out on the streets and get anything. I mean, I got stuff for free. And then I decided I needed to move back to Huntsville. I couldn't work on my own. I had these children. I needed to have partners. And so I moved back to Huntsville with another group that was sponsored by Huntsville Hospital and worked with these three other women that I knew from residency. I had attendings and other people who trained with me, and it was just wonderful. But they also, I sort of at that time thought, maybe I shouldn't be doing this. But see, when I got there, they had this wonderful sample closet that was full of this stuff. So, you know, I just felt like I needed to keep doing this. And I don't know at what point I lost control, but for 7 years, things just seemed to get worse and worse. During that time, I got the bright idea that we shouldn't have to be beholden to anybody. We should be our own doctors. Let's build our own clinic and, you know, we'll forget about the hospital. So that's what we did. I was really good at talking people into doing things with me. I don't know why why they followed me, but that was the way it was. So we built this clinic. We started our practice together. But you know, the stress was building. I didn't relate, you know, drinking and this other stuff with stress. I just knew that my drinking was worsening and my use of this stuff was worsening. I started drinking heavily at night, hoping to get off of this stuff. See, I never thought I had an alcohol problem. I thought it was this other stuff. I started seeing a therapist 2 years before I went to treatment, so it must have been 98 or so, because I went in 2000. Remember, I do everything every 10 years. So that's how I can remember. But I started seeing this wonderful therapist, because I thought, stress. If I handled my stress better, I wouldn't have to drink. I wouldn't have to do this stuff. And that man saw me every 2 weeks, and he saw me get worse and worse and worse. If he ever asked me if I drank or was taking anything, I don't remember it, and I'm sure if he did, I would have lied. Because to me, that was not my problem. It's too embarrassing to talk about that. I knew I had stress, by golly. That's what was driving this. I was dealing with life and death every day. That's what I told my husband. really. It got so bad that going to my therapist one day, he looked at me and he said, Nancy, you have burnout. You have physician burnout. And I like that. He said, as a matter of fact, you're beyond burnout. And I really love that diagnosis. Because, you know, right before he told me that, I was thinking I had a brain tumor. I really did. I didn't know what the hell was wrong with me, and talked one of my partners into ordering a MRI of my brain, because I just knew there was a tumor there. That would explain a whole lot. I was never so disappointed to find out I didn't have a tumor. I wanted an explanation. Well, when this guy told me I was beyond burnout, I clung to that. I thought, okay, we were financially set to where I could quit work for a while. I told my partner, sorry, I'm taking leave of absence, I'm out of here. I have beyond burnout. Great diagnosis. And I decided I would see my therapist twice a week, or every week instead of every 2 weeks. I would see him every week. And I read all these self-help books. I started exercising. I started eating right. I made sure I got a good night's sleep. And I was getting massages. And I just knew that that was going to fix me. Problem was, I rapidly got much worse. Andrew would make a gin and tonic at night and have a gin and tonic. On rare occasions, maybe two. And he would go to bed. I couldn't wait until he went to bed and the kids were asleep, because that was me time. I would take that gin bottle down and I would pour drinks the way I wanted to pour them. And initially they were just very strong gin and tonics. And then the tonic went away. And then they were just glassfuls of gin. And my goal was to pass out. And I would guzzle that. Somebody once asked me, why didn't you just drink out of the bottle? I'd pour it into a water glass. You know, I'm not an animal. But it was so hard. My life became so complicated because I couldn't let the liquor stores know that I had a problem. I was really trying to keep track of what liquor store I went to, because I'd have to go get that gin, because I'd have to refill that bottle. So Andrew wouldn't know how much I was drinking. He just knew I had become strange. His word was bizarre. And he didn't know what was wrong with me. He once asked me, are you taking anything? Or, no, don't you know I deal with this incredible stress? I deal with life and death. This is all stress. And he bought it. But I got so bad that I realized after about 4 months being off of work that it was so bad that I couldn't go back to work if I wanted to, that I was a mess. So I thought, you know, I had tried to quit. Every morning I woke up and go, okay, today I'm not going to take anything, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to do anything. And that resolve was gone by evening, every day. It was like Groundhog Day, over and over and over again. So I figured I'm not being good about being accountable to myself, but if I tell my therapist, he can't tell anybody, and I can get him to breathalyze me and do drug screens. So that was a great plan. So that's what I went in with and told him, this is, you know, I've got this problem and I can't control it myself. I need you to do this for me. And the man jumped up and hugged me and said, Nancy, you just took step one of a 12-step program. I was like, what are you talking about? I hadn't heard of the 12 steps. He said, how does this strike you? We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives would become unmanageable. I was like, oh my God, that's me. Where do I find these people? And he goes, oh, there's groups all over the place. You know, I said, well, I will look them up, but if you'll just drug screen me and breathalyze me, I'll be all right. He's like, no, Nancy, you don't understand. This is a much bigger problem than you realize. You need to go to treatment. And of course, I was like, oh no, I'm a big, important doctor. That would ruin me. You don't understand. And he was so good. He said, well, how about I have a doctor that's in recovery call you? And I was in shock. This is what a closet alcoholic I was. I had no idea there was such a thing as an alcoholic doctor. I really didn't. I thought I was the only one. Is that delusional or what? I really did. So this guy called me that night, and I recognized this doctor's voice, and I thought, oh my God. And he had numerous years in recovery, and he said, Nancy, just go to treatment, do what they tell you to do, you're going to be okay. And that meant a lot to me, because here I am talking to someone who apparently understands me, what I'm going through, But he told me, he said, hang on for the roller coaster ride, though. He said, because you're going to be up, the biggest ups, biggest downs. It'll whip you around. Hang on, hang on, hang on. And one day you're going to step off the roller coaster and you'll wonder what happened and realize you're off. And I was so grateful he told me about that. He told me, just go to treatment, do what they tell you to do, and you're going to be okay. And so he encouraged me to call the medical board, let them know I was going to treatment, which I did. I expected them to yell at me. The guy that answered the phone was so nice. I think as an alcoholic, we think everybody should hate us. Well, we do a lot of things where they should hate us, but, you know, I thought automatically they should hate me. But the guy was so nice. Oh, you poor thing, I'll come visit you while you're in treatment. And I thought, what the heck? And so I went to treatment, but the problem was that they couldn't get me in when I wanted them to, which was that day. They wanted to wait until Monday, which was like 3 days later, to admit me. And this was down at UAB. This is where this doctor recommended I go. I had decided this is my quit date. I'm quitting. This is it. I went with my husband to the video store and got a bunch of movies because I knew that I wouldn't be sleeping, that I'd be sick, probably those hot and cold sweats. I read all about withdrawal. And, you know, 28 days had come out at that time with Sandra Bullock. I watched that in withdrawal. It was fun. So I was a crazy woman. I was sick, hot and cold sweats, couldn't sleep, up and down. I knew I wasn't going to be able to sleep. I didn't realize Andrew was afraid of me. He'd go into the bedroom and lock the door. I told him I was going to stay on the couch because I knew I wouldn't be sleeping. And I remember putting my hands on my hips at one point and yelling at him, you know this is all your fault. I helped him with his Al-Anon program, by the way. I take credit for it. Because when I went off to treatment, he, in his story, he said that that's when he went to Al-Anon. So we've sort of been in recovery together, and it's been fascinating how our programs sort of mesh. I learned some things from him. He'd learned some things from me on how we do the steps. It was just the neatest experience. Not to say that it wasn't rocky to begin with. You know, when I first got into recovery, I was all over the place. It was just like that guy had said. I'd have the highest highs, the lowest lows. I thought, you know, this is never going to stop. They'd make fun of me at my, there's a group called the Caduceus group that a lot of doctors are required to attend early in recovery. And some days I'd be there, oh, my husband, my life is wonderful. And then the next time I'd be there, I gotta divorce his ass. You know, this is awful. Life sucks. So it became a running joke as to whether I was, you know, gonna be divorcing or staying in my marriage. They had told me to get a sponsor. You know, I thought, when I saw those steps, I didn't like them. You know, the first step I could live with, I couldn't, you know, when it's mentioned God, ooh, that brought up some stuff for me. I was made to go to church when I was a little kid. But it didn't appeal to me. I liked the stories and everything, but I thought, everybody's a hypocrite. You know, they're nice in church, but they go out and I watch all this bad behavior. And I just didn't get it. My mom gave me the choice when we moved one time. I was 10 years old, and she said, you don't have to go to church if you don't want to. So I decided I'm not going to church anymore because I wanted to sleep in on Sundays. Why bother? But the funny thing was, I didn't realize at that time, I had this desire. You know, in the book, in the big book, we talk about it, inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. And I was searching and didn't know it at the time. I thought when I came into this program, I was an atheist, but really what I was an agnostic. Thank God there was a chapter for me. I thought when I got my sponsor, I didn't want a sponsor at first because I thought, I'm smart. I went to medical school. I can figure out anything, you know? And they're like, no, you have to have a sponsor. You have to have someone to guide you through those steps. And so at one of the meetings, I finally got up the courage to ask the chairperson for a sponsor. You know, do you know someone who could be, you know, a sponsor for me? And he said, oh, the woman who spoke here the other night, she lives this program, da-da-da, and hands me her phone number. Well, she wasn't there that day. And it's like, okay, thank you very much. I was not going to call this woman. A few meetings later was a birthday night, and, you know, there were a lot of people there that I didn't know, but one of them really stood out to me. My therapist's secretary was there. And, you know, in the 2 years I was going to see the therapist, we really hit it off. I'd visit with her before and after, you know, my time with the therapist, and just loved her. Well, she was there. And, oh, my God, I was like, oh, I know this is an open meeting, but I've got to duck down so she can't see me because I don't want her to know I'm here. You know, I'm so embarrassed. But then she got up and got, like, an 18-year medallion. And then I was very excited. I went up to her and said, oh, you could be my sponsor. She was like, no, I can't. I'm your friend. You cannot have a friend as a sponsor. So I told her, I said, well, they gave me this lady's number. And she goes, oh, I sponsor her. And she pulls out her little flip phone and dials her up and says, hey, Brenda, I want you to talk to this girl. I want you to be your sponsor. And hands me the phone. And I'm just really, hi, this is Nancy. Would you be willing to be my temporary sponsor? And she was so nice on the phone. Oh, yeah. I'd be honored. That was her words. I'd be honored. Meet me tomorrow before the meeting, and we'll go over a few things. So hang up, and then I thought, oh, great. You know, I was in partial hospitalization program where we got to go home at night, and we could go to our meetings and just go during the day. Monday through Friday, we did our treatment. They told me I couldn't leave until I got a sponsor and got through my fifth step. So I was like, oh, I better hurry up. So I got, I'm, after I hung up, my friend looks at me and she goes, now, there's a few things I need to warn you about. She's gay. She's really rough. She has anger issues. She used to hit people. So I taught her to put her hands in her pockets. She can't read very well. She's really learning how to read out of the big book. And I was like, oh, my God. She didn't tell me this beforehand. I thought I was looking for someone sort of like me. I thought, this is not going to work. But, you know, they told me to be open-minded, you know, and willing. And I thought, but this is tough. You know, I met her the next day. When she walked through that door, I thought, oh, my God, she's going to either hit me or hit on me, and I'm not going to like either one of those things, and I've got to get me somebody that I can relate to. But that woman is still my sponsor today. And I wouldn't trade her for the world. She taught me through her actions, and she made it so simple on how to do those steps. I told her about my problems with God. You know, I don't really believe in God. You know, little children are being raped and murdered. Where's a loving God in that? Come on now. And she said, oh, well, okay. Don't forget to say a prayer and thank, you know, ask God to keep you sober today, and if you stay sober, say a prayer at night and thank Him for keeping you sober. I thought, I looked at her and said, you're asking me to believe something that I just told you I have trouble with. And she said, I didn't ask you to believe anything. I asked you to do something. I asked you to say a prayer. She said, frankly, I don't care if you're thinking about llamas while you're doing it. Just take the action of saying that prayer. And so that's where I learned that this is a program of action, not of thinking. She told me think was not for me. I wasn't allowed to. She told me, for me, my head was a dangerous neighborhood. Don't go there alone. You're going to get mugged every time. And she was absolutely right. If I started thinking, I was in trouble. My grand sponsor taught me to be where my hands are. You know, she said, use your senses if you have to. She said, look around, see what's the color of the floor. You know, if you're driving, look out the window, look for billboards. You know, what color's the background, what color's the writing. You know, bark on the tree, is it rough, is it, you know. And that would bring me back to the moment, to be where my hands are. Because I was terrible about jumping into the future. Then this is going to happen, then that's going to happen. And I was going to be a mess. I would think, thunk. It was terrible. I had a lot of wonderful God experiences in my recovery. Tell you one of them, early in recovery, I guess I was probably 6 months in recovery, I got suicidal. Never been suicidal in my life. And I got suicidal. I'm grateful for that experience because I know what it feels like now. You know, it's funny to be grateful for something, but there's always some benefits to experiences. I was on my back deck wanting to kill myself because I had done my fifth step with my sponsor. And I was looking forward to doing that because I wanted to feel better. That was my whole purpose of doing the fifth step. All of you shared in meetings of how wonderful that was and, oh, how freeing that was. I wanted that because here I was working on these steps and it felt like I was getting my fingers up on the wall and I was looking out over, starting to see what the rest of you were seeing. And then I lose my grip and there was a wall again. And I kept going, what's going on here? Well, I did my fifth step with my sponsor to her house and I didn't feel great. I just felt a little awkward. She shared things with me that were similar to what I shared with her, which made me feel better. She told me she loved me. That was nice. But I just felt weird. And I backed into her fence as I was leaving her house. But I went home and I was determined that I was going to do everything right. I put that book up on the shelf and I took it down. I hear that. So many people do that. We're so funny. And, you know, was going through, making sure that, you know, I told her everything. But then I started thinking, you know, it's obvious this program's not working for me. And I dug into that thought. And I dug in so hard, I thought, you know, I can't go back to drinking. I felt like I died on the inside before I told that therapist what was going on. I remember many mornings standing in front of the mirror, looking at my eyes, just looking in there for any hint of life. And I was looking in dead eyes. I couldn't go back to that. You know, I'd rather be dead. And I couldn't work my way up to killing myself because I kept thinking about my kids. But then another thought came to me. This therapist had shared one time about how his wife, who's also, they're both PhDs, and they would do this hypnosis with some of their patients and take them back into their childhoods. And she had relayed to him about taking a patient too far back into another lifetime. It was like, really? Come on now. Because he was a big Christian. I said, you know, Christians don't believe in reincarnation. And he said, so I said, how do you make sense of that? He said, well, what if we're here to learn? Whatever we don't get this time around, we get to come back and do it again. And for some reason, that thought hit me. And it was like, oh my God, if he's right, I can't go through this again. And all I could think of is I've got to do something. And I decided to go to a meeting that night because it was birthday night. And I thought, you know, I've been sitting here on my deck for a while and people are going to start calling me. I wasn't thinking a meeting was going to help me. I just went. And I found another guy who was suicidal, and that was a whole lot of fun. We went to the back of the room, one of the other rooms, and talked about how much this program wasn't helping us. And, you know, we both wanted to die. It was a great conversation. The meeting ends, and I come out of the room, and I see my sponsor, and she comes over to me. Hey, Nancy, I haven't heard from you in a while. Oh, yeah, Brenda, this is not working. It's just, you know, it's just not working for me. And just then another doctor friend of mine shows up with a patient of his that didn't want to go to treatment but was willing to come to meetings. And he goes, hey, Nancy, I think you'd be a great temporary sponsor for this girl. I thought to myself, really? Because this guy had seen me in better days. I think the last time he saw me at our Caduceus meeting, I was in much better shape. I was on cloud nine. And just then my grand sponsor walked by too, and she knew all of us. Hey, what are y'all talking about? And he said, well, I want Nancy to be temporary sponsor. She said, oh, I think that's a lovely idea, and walks off. And so my sponsor's looking at me, I'm looking at her, then I look at this girl and I thought, you know, it's not working for me, but who am I to deprive her of her chance? You know, because I've seen it work for so many people, it just wasn't working for me. So I said, well, let's get you a book. Walked her over, got her a big book, and walked her to the door. Okay, you know, let's meet tomorrow before the meeting. We'll go over a few things. Just what my sponsor did with me. And my sponsor grabbed me by the arm when she left. She said, don't you tell her a damn thing without running it by me first. And so I was like, yeah. You know, and on my way home, all I could think of was, what do I need to tell her? Oh, yeah, she's got to call me every day. She needs to pray every morning, ask God to keep her sober. I was thinking of all these things my sponsor had done with me. And so when I got up the next morning, the sky was blue. The grass was green. It was like a reset button had been hit. And, you know, God does for me what I can't do for myself. You know, I think he expects me to do what I can, but I believe he put that girl in my path to get me out of me. See, I didn't realize what a big problem I am. It's all about me. When I can get out of me, I'm a much happier person. You know, sponsees always apologize, just like I did with my sponsor. Oh, I'm sorry to bother you. No, she told me, you're helping me more than I'm helping you. And I thought, what a load of crap. She's lying. You know, I'm bothering her. But she's just trying to be nice. Okay, I can accept that. I didn't understand until she had me, you know, really out there. She got me through the steps. And she said, you've got to really get out there and start sponsoring other women. And I was like, oh, no, I can't do that because I'm a very busy doctor. And I'm a mom, and I have a busy life. Really what it was, I was afraid. I was terrified that I would say something or do something, and they would go get drunk, and it would be my fault. When I finally fessed up to her, she told me, you don't have the power to get them drunk, and you don't have the power to keep them sober. Your job is to be a guide and get them to God, just like I did with you. I didn't believe in God, but I had so many experiences, God incidences. We were in Disney World when I was a couple years sober, I guess. That was the closest I came to relapse. It was a happy place. Who's going to relapse in Disney World? Me. Found out that's one of my biggest triggers is when things are going great. My sister-in-law, Andrew's sister, had come with us. And she had shared on the plane that her doctor gave her Xanax. Now, that was not my thing, let me tell you. That was not my thing. To help her sleep. And so I was supposed to go out shopping for souvenirs one day, and they had taken the kids down to the pool, and I saw they had some drinks of some sort. I didn't know if they were alcoholic or not, but all of a sudden, I had to have something. I had to have something. And then it hit me. She has Xanax. I could go into, you know, I looked all over for that. I looked under her pillow. I looked in the medicine cabinet. And then I got more frantic. I started digging through her purse that was sitting there. Never could find it. You know, if I had found that, I would have relapsed. Couldn't find it. Totally frustrated. I grabbed the rental car keys. I went downstairs to the lobby. Happened to look over my shoulder. And on a little bill, you know, on a little easel, there was this little sign that said, Friends of Bill, meeting in room such and such. I thought, whoa. And it felt like this cold water had been thrown on me. I was like, whoa, okay. And I told my sponsor about it afterwards, and I said, what a coincidence. And she said, Nancy, that's not a coincidence. That's a God incidence. She said, there are no coincidences. They're all God incidences. So through my experiences with God, I've developed a personal relationship with God. I pray to God. Another time earlier on when I was going, I had to go before the wellness committee at the hospital to keep my privileges, and that was, oof. These were people that I knew on this committee. Some of them had been students under me when I was in residency. They were medical students, and I was just mortified. And, you know, I hadn't really gotten into the God idea. And my sponsor told me, I called her on the way and said, I'm terrified. She said, well, take God with you. Click. Hangs up on me. Okay. Well, and then I'm driving along and I'm looking at the seat next to me going, okay, God, I need you to come with me. I really need you to come with me. I'm terrified. And a thought came to me, just tell the truth. And, you know, terrified. When I got there, I put my hand on the door to go inside. All of a sudden, I was completely at peace. You know, I just told them the truth, did everything I needed to, and, you know, they were pretty happy with that. As a matter of fact, they never called me back as much as they were supposed to. I guess they bought it. But, you know, that was God there, and I recognized that that was God. And I've had episodes where, throughout my sobriety, where I feel like God has talked to me. I was struggling with something, and I went out onto my back deck one night. I was struggling with a problem, and I pray in my mind, and I was asking God, I was saying, God, what would you have me, the word be, inserted itself for do, what would you have me be? And all of a sudden, I heard kind and loving, be kind and loving. And I thought on that for a second, I thought, oh my God, that's the answer. If I don't know what to do in a situation, all I need to do is be kind and loving. The answers will come. And that was huge for me. I wanted to stay home from a meeting, and my favorite show was coming on television because it was fall, and the new series had started up, and I was, you know, I was sort of checking myself, do I need a meeting? I don't think so, I'm doing pretty good. And I was sitting down to watch my show, and all of a sudden I got this voice in my head. It was not mine. It said, but what if someone else needs you there? And it was such a powerful, powerful thing that I immediately, you know, recorded the show and left to go to the meeting. Now, I don't remember what happened at that meeting or what was going on, but that wasn't my thought. That's not the way I think. You know, I think that's all God. You know, we were talking earlier about the people that have spoken here. Marty Mann, I was going to call him Charlie Chaplin, but it was Chuck Chamberlain. It's so funny because I love that man, one of my heroes. He said, you know, there is one problem that contains or encompasses all problems, and that is conscious separation from God. And there is one solution, you know, that contains all solutions, and that is conscious contact with God. And such a simple idea, and such a huge truth. And I love all of you, and I want you to know that the God in me can see the God in you. Thank you.
Thank you.